Broadcast out of New York City, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health on the Progressive Radio Network on Monday, February 3rd, 2014. I'm Dr. Len Saputo.
I wonder whose birthday is tomorrow.
Ah, happy birthday, Len. Huh?
Happy birthday to you.
39 again. Isn't that Jack Benny's thing?
That's it.
For those of you who remember who Jack Benny was. That's right.
And I'm registered nurse Vicki Saputo. Thank you for joining us on Prescriptions for Health on the Progressive Radio Network on the first and third Monday of every month from 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time and from 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time. And remember that our shows are available 24/7 on PRN.fm and DrSaputo.com.
Today you'll hear Nurse Vicki's 2020 health tips at 20 after and 20 to the hour. And we've got another great show for you today that's going to include why the FDA's criteria for approving new drugs will blow your mind.
And how can warning labels be dangerous?
And can you work out every day and still be categorized as sedentary?
And how well does a treatment work when your doctor lays a guilt trip on you?
And how about do coronary arteriograms actually cause strokes?
We have a lot of hot topics today.
I'll say.
Well, the FDA approval has a lot of power behind it, and there's no respect in the medical industry if any drugs or medical devices don't have FDA approval.
Yeah, it's amazing, you know, that we really do think of it that way. And then we look at all the things that the FDA does, and we're criticizing it all the time, and yet we still make the connection.
Well, it's the first thing people ask.
Yeah.
Is it FDA approved?
Mm-hmm.
But why? Can we trust the FDA?
Right.
Now, we recently talked about the FDA and its relationship with Big Pharma and how it compromises the safety of medications, mm-hmm. with pharmaceutical drugs the third most common cause of U.S. deaths.
Yeah, that'll blow you away.
And there's a new study published in JAMA, that's the Journal of the American Medical Association, that looks at the criteria used by the FDA for approving new drugs and medical devices,
mm-hmm.
that's pretty worrisome.
Awesome.
So tell us more about this study and what it's revealing about FDA practices.
Okay. Well, this is a study that was done at the Yale School of Medicine. And what they did is they looked at the clinical trials that were done by the FDA to approve new drugs between the years 2005 and 2012. And what they looked at is how thorough were they? And they found that the amount of thoroughness varied widely depending on the particular study. And they found that more than a third of the drugs were approved on the basis of a single trial, no replications, just one trial. And we know that when somebody does a clinical trial and there's a conflict of interest because they paid for it, like some pharmaceutical company trying to approve a drug like Vioxx, which we might get to at some time in this program today. It's amazing. They're very often very small studies that are short. They're focused on lab values or some other marker that's not really that accurate of a marker. And then we wind up with these things being presented to the public and to our doctors, and that's what's happening in our...
So some of these trials are pretty rigorous, and some are vague, and some
yes.
are rushed through, and some of them, they just really don't even do studies.
So how do you tell when they're going to do what? I can tell you some things from personal experience, because I know in the case of trying to approve the photon stimulator, okay, with an indication for peripheral neuropathy from diabetes, which we know works because we've been doing it for 15 years. In fact, it's amazing to me when you get logical about it that we even have to do a clinical trial at all on it because it works. It's not like, does it work? It works because we treat people who have it, who've had it for years, and they get better. What more evidence do you want than that? And yet at the same time, the FDA didn't approve our request to make that something that would be reimbursable so that doctors would actually use it. And then you've got other studies like the fast track studies, Vicki, where what happens is a pharmaceutical company will come to the FDA and they'll say, we've got a really hot drug here that might be valuable to use for somebody who has cancer. And what will happen is they'll pay the FDA a lot of money to fast track it, meaning to pay attention to it now and get it done within a 6-month period, which of course saves them a ton of money because of all the time that would be continued to do more research. And they very often pass those things, even though they're preliminary studies that haven't been tested over a long period of time. And there's an actual conflict of interest between the pharmaceutical company and the FDA because of the amount of money that's paid, which is millions of dollars,
well, not
to do
only,
that.
But not only that, who's on the FDA board. There are people from the pharmaceutical companies. 20% of the FDA's board are pharmaceutical companies.
Well,
certainly they're knowledgeable about the medications and so
forth. Yeah, they should be there to promote
the drug. But like you
said,
though, there's too much conflict of interest and much bias.
Well, should they have a vote? I mean, that's where the rubber meets the road. Certainly you want their information because they're the people who did the clinical trial. They know what happened, and they can, if they're honest, tell you what you need to know about that clinical trial. But to give them a vote, I mean, that's insanity. That's like giving an automatic yes. How would you feel if you were representing a drug company in that setting and you voted no, our drug's no good, and then you went back to work on Monday? What do you think would happen to you? I mean, that's just like a no-brainer.
Well, another thing that was really kind of bothering me is that the trials for the drugs for chronic treatments only last for a year.
A lot of them are a lot less than that.
So they're going to give these to people for forever, for the rest of their lives, and they've only checked them for a year?
Well, or less. What happens if they've checked it for a few weeks, which is often the case, too. So what we need is some kind of standard that makes sense, and that's why we should continue to do these post-approval tracking of drugs for years to see what happens. But a lot of the
time, they
don't
do it. But they don't do it.
No. So how would you get the information then in an accurate way that would tell you whether or not this is a good drug, or actually it turns out that it kills some people, or it causes things you didn't expect, like heart attacks and strokes and seizures and cancer. I mean, wow.
Well, you know, if these FDA variable trial standards are in major medical journals like JAMA, many of our doctors assume that they're effective and safe,
so
as well as the patients. Well, but, I mean, if the doctors do, where do you go with that?
Well, what you have to do is be honest about it. You know, because it says Journal of the American Medical Association or New England Journal of Medicine or British Medical Journal doesn't mean that it's going to have good articles in it, meaning that they're scientific and accurate.
And then so how do they get by with changing the study criteria when it pleases them due to their conflict of interest?
Well,
that happens too.
It does happen, and it should never happen, but it does. And so what we have here is a double standard. We know the FDA is corrupt, and here is more evidence as to why it is. We know that the medical journals are publishing information that we can't believe. How do you feel when you're in the hospital and you're sick, say in the ICU or in the coronary care unit or some other intensive unit for care, and your doctor is reading a new article and comes out and says, this is what the literature shows, and it's all stuff that's not true?
And say, let's try this.
Yeah, and it actually has very little chance of working. I mean, look at the work of Marcia Angel, the physician from Harvard, who was the chief editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, who, after being with them for 20 years, quit her job and started writing books about why you can't trust the articles that are coming into print because they have these conflicts of interest. And the pharmaceutical industry is the most guilty because they spend $92 billion a year on research, whereas our NIH, National Institutes of Health, spends about $32 billion a year. So they're not going to publish things that they don't want to because they're a business. And they expect to be able to put out information that's going to convince doctors and patients. And that's why they do direct-to-consumer ads. It's not just for you. It's for your doctor to listen on TV, too. That's what they're thinking is. It's a business.
Well, it's pretty scary. You know, with 20% of the FDA-approved drugs having black box warnings, or they take them off the market.
Yeah, within a few years, that's what happens. And you can understand that would happen occasionally, but you know that there are conflicts of interest that occur and that drugs get put out that are marketed that shouldn't be there. And this is statistic you just gave is a beautiful piece of information that tells a story. I mean, when 20% of the drugs, that's one in five drugs that are approved by the FDA, actually turns out to be far more serious than we thought, and a lot of the time has to be taken off the market, that's like, wow. I mean, look at a drug like Darvon. Probably many of you don't remember that drug. That was out in the 60s, and it was taken off the market a couple of years ago because they finally found the information that showed that it caused problems that could be fatal, like fatal cardiac rhythm disturbances. It's on the market for 50 years. It's like it's hard to believe that these kinds of things can happen in the country that's supposed to have the most sophisticated technology in the world. And yet that's what actually happens.
Well, then, too, only 40% of them are compared with other available drugs.
Well, that's a big deal. I mean, you're looking at a new drug coming to market. Ask yourself the question, why is this drug coming out? Does it offer something that the other drugs don't? Or is this just another drug that's coming out to replace one that has lost its patent, like with Lipitor? You know, Lipitor, its patent is expired. It's now over the counter. And so there are going to be new drugs that wanted to fill that spot. And they may not be any better at all. In fact, they may be worse, and they certainly won't be as well tested. And that's what happens. What about the head-to-head trials? Where are they? You know, particularly with anticoagulants, you're looking at things like Coumadin and Pradaxa, the new one that's out there, and heparin and aspirin and some of the other things that are available in nutritional medicine, like natokinase and
fish oil
and ginkgo. Where are the direct studies that compare one to the other? Wouldn't
they
you like
don't
to want
to compare any drugs to nutraceuticals.
No. Well, I mean, there's no profit in that. And yet we, the people, are entitled to have that. And our National Institutes of Health fails us miserably when it comes to things like that. And it has to tell you that they're geared to be responsive to the people who have money as well. Because a lot of the clinical trials that are done, as we said, it's a 2-to-1 ratio or 3-to-1 ratio. Big Pharma funds all these studies. And there's a lot of money that goes into that industry that a lot of people depend on, and they don't want to see a change.
And do the doctors and the patients understand the benefits and the harms of the trial results when they're deciding to use the new approved drugs?
Well, that's really right. Drugs. I mean, when they did a survey, an internet survey of 4,300 people, and 40% of the people felt that the FDA approved only very effective drugs. And yet most of the time what you have is another drug that's kind of like a lookalike of the other one. I mean, look at a lot of your antihypertensive drugs that fall into a single class. They're all the same. But when the patents expire, there's a new one right there, and they're saying, oh, this might be better for that reason. And it puts the idea in your head that it might be better, and they might not be as good. About 25% of people thought that drugs had no serious side effects because the FDA approved all that. In fact, some doctors who were surveyed thought that, too. It's unbelievable.
Well, just because a drug is new, many times people think that that means that it's better. So
I always thought that. I was trained.
Oh, you did?
Up until about the early 1980s, I thought that. That, oh, there's a new drug out. There's a new breakthrough. I want to learn everything about it and try it. Of course, that's ass backwards.
And that's putting your patients at risk because
absolutely.
They're the guinea pigs.
Well, look at what the
because
pharmaceutical...
Look at how short the trials are and look at how these studies are that we're just talking about
and
here.
The conflicts of interest, and they're not comparative. I mean, these are things that are huge.
Well, some of them aren't proven effective, but they say that they're likely to benefit the patient.
Well, that's
what
right.
They do with some of the ones that they speed them through.
Well, a lot of the cancer drugs are like that. And yet when you look at the 5-year survival rate for people who have a solid tumor, like a breast cancer that's metastatic, or a lung cancer, or a pancreatic cancer, or a kidney cancer, the 5-year survival for stage 4 people with the best treatment that the oncologists in the U.S. have is about 2%, 2.2%. That means 2.2 people out of 100 are going to be alive at 5 years using standard therapy if they're average. And it doesn't mean there aren't some people who do better. And, of course, there are many that do worse. They die in a matter of just weeks. So when you start looking at averages like that, you can get the wrong idea about this. So we need information that's accurate and that we can trust, that doesn't have conflict of interest, and where business is not the bottom line that determines whether or not this is something we want to do.
Well, we need some certainty about these drugs.
I'll say.
Not just thinking that they're likely to benefit the patient.
Well,
and they have these standards that are really not standards. They're just variables.
Well, Vicki, there's a revolving door between people who work at the FDA and the CDC and the pharmaceutical industry. And there are lots of cases where people do their work when they're on those big committees, the government committees, FDA and CDC, who 5 years later are working for who? Big Pharma.
Well, we've known this and talked about this many times in the past, and a lot of this isn't new, but this study that came out you know, in JAMA that's looking at the criteria really is exposing the FDA.
Yeah. Now, the good part about that is it came out of Yale. Maybe the bad part about it is that it's in a journal like the Journal of American Medical Association. But when something negative like this gets published in a journal like that,
that's a big deal.
That's a big deal. Because I'm less likely to believe a study where there's a conflict of interest because some company has sponsored and written the study, which is what happens so often. So we have to come to our senses. It's like we're in a trance. You know, we watch a direct-to-consumer ad on TV, and if we really listen to it, you'd have to be insane after listening to the side effects to try the drug to protect you, for example, from having dry eyes or, you know, or some other thing that you can live with.
What's interesting, we're going to be talking about that a little more later, you know, about the warnings that are on the labels.
Well, yeah, and I think you might be surprised at how those warnings work. I think you will be. I know I was surprised when I saw that. So somehow we have to question things. We have to question authority. We have to look at the reasons why studies are being done and look at what the businesses are trying to achieve by doing their research and to promote things.
But why would somebody like the, you know, the FDA not have standards of criteria
that are
for
fixed.
These that are fixed?
Yeah, well, they call it being flexible. Oh. Okay, being able to use criteria
but
when it's appropriate.
But who oversees the FDA? Why is this allowed to go on? Why is this happening?
I can tell you who oversees the FDA. Big Pharma, a lot of the time. When you're paying millions and millions of dollars to the FDA because you're fast-tracking drugs, that gives you power because they then become dependent on that income to do what they do. And a lot of people's jobs depend on that money as a source of payment.
So what can be done about it?
Well, we could eliminate the money going back to the FDA.
Who's we?
We the people. We could prevent, we could say it's illegal. Congress needs to step in here. And of course, Congress is in Big Pharma's pocket too.
Yeah, see, that's the problem.
So how do you get Congress to change the rules that say we're not going to give that money to people who are in a position to have a conflict of interest? So don't give them the money. Put that in the National Treasury somewhere. And if the Congress wants to put more money in the FDA, then they can. But they sure shouldn't have a direct payment system between the industry that makes the product, whether it's a drug or some kind of technology. They shouldn't be the ones paying money to the FDA because, of course, that sets up a conflict of interest. Then it's like the good old boys club. You know, you scratch my back, I'll scratch your back. And we do that by giving favors. And that's what's happening here, and it's got to stop.
Well, yeah, we've got to stop it, and I don't really know what the first step is to stop it, but I guess the first step is knowing about it. So now we know about it, and it has been exposed in the Journal of American Medical Association. So,
well, listen, this whole topic is one that talks about the challenges we face as a culture, and how we set up our value system. And as long as money is king and we're materialistic and we want power, you're going to see things like this happen. It's inevitable. Until we evolve beyond the place where we are so that we have values that have to do with building community and sharing and caring and giving, nothing's going to change. So the ball's in our court. Either we step up to the plate and bat and start making some changes, and that starts with each individual person. It doesn't start with Congress because Congress has got too much corruption in it. It's on a pathway all of its own that doesn't serve us well. But if we start making changes, we the people start making changes, and we spend our money wisely, meaning on only those things that are warranted as good for the culture, it'll change the way we see the whole culture operate. And until then, things are like they are.
Hear ye.
Yeah. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki, and it's time for Nurse Vicki's first 2020 tip on some of Vicki's favorite quotes. And when we come back, we'll be talking about how can warning labels be dangerous.
I have some quotes to ponder. Whenever you answer a question you don't feel like answering, you give your power away.
Yeah, you don't look like you know what you're talking about.
A lot of the pain that we're dealing with are really only thoughts.
Indeed, that's so common with post-traumatic stress syndrome. It's those old tapes that keep playing that we develop tools for as we get older, but at the time it happened, we don't have the tools because we're kids. And then those old tapes keep playing, and they cause certain buttons to be pushed, and then we're stuck.
Worry is a total waste of time. It doesn't change anything. All it does is steal your joy and keeps you very busy doing nothing.
Especially in the middle of the night when you're pondering all that stuff.
Exactly. Never respond to rudeness. When people are rude to you, they reveal who they are, not who you are. So don't take it personally. Be silent.
Yeah, they're inviting you to be like they are, and you don't need to do that.
It's so tempting.
It sure is.
Do not get upset with people or situations. Both are powerless without your reaction.
They depend on your reaction. That's right.
You can't fix yourself by breaking somebody else. You know, that's like putting other people down to build yourself up. It does not work.
A lot of people do that. They're very insecure ones. That's how they operate. It doesn't make you feel good, does it?
You can't calm the storm, so stop trying. What you can do is calm yourself. The storm will pass.
Right.
Here's one from Vincent van Gogh. Normality is a paved road. It's comfortable to walk, but no flowers grow on it.
That's right. It's just the old mundane thing.
Maybe through the cracks.
You don't even have to think, right? In fact, that's the beauty of it. You feel comfortable in doing a kind of behavior a lot of the time that doesn't serve you well.
When you repeat a mistake, it's not a mistake anymore. It's a decision.
It's a pattern. You're right.
So be kind to unkind people. They need it the most.
They sure do. A lot of doctors should be listening to that one carefully. We should be listening and caring rather than judging.
Exactly. And kindness, it's not an act. It's a lifestyle. Makes me think of that random acts of kindness.
I love it. Yeah.
When our actions are based on good intentions, our soul has no regrets.
So true. Build up your karma. You're only here for a tenth of a second anyway out of 14 billion year history of the earth. So you might as well do it the best you can and leave a legacy that you're proud of.
So how can warning labels be dangerous to our health? Aren't they to protect us? Well, research shows that they can actually promote trust and consequently more purchases in the long run.
Isn't that the oddest thing?
Well, this must be why those medicines in the ads...
Uh-huh.
That, you know, they list all the dangerous side effects. Yeah, that must be why they work on television.
I think we listen more to the violin in the background that sounds like such beautiful music.
Well, anyway, let's take a look at maybe the warning labels on cigarettes, for example. Like, how do they make smoking more appealing? Mm-hmm. I mean, we're going to talk about the longer the time lapse between learning about the warning and purchasing the product promotes trust.
Yeah, it's kind of odd the way the mind works. You know, we've been talking about placebo the last few shows, at least to some extent. And in one of the studies, it was on irritable bowel syndrome. They gave people a little blue pill that was printed on a placebo. So it actually had a label on it, said this is a placebo. And the doctor in the study said, we're giving you a placebo. There's nothing in it, but please take it for 6 weeks. And in the other group, they gave them nothing. So that served as a control. Well, at the end of 6 weeks, the people who were taking the little blue placebo pill got better than the group that did nothing. So you have to ask yourself the question, what happened there? Our conscious mind gets it. It says, this is stupid, there's nothing in it. But our unconscious mind is trained to believe that when you take a pill, that it's going to have a value to it. And so you unconsciously respond to change your biochemistry and physiology in ways where you get better. It's bizarre.
So what does that have to do with the time lapse between reading the label and not?
Well, I think we have time. I mean, if you immediately are warned that this is bad for you, you remember it. And if somebody says, you want to buy it now? The answer is no, I don't think so. But after time passes, like a few weeks or a few months, the mind forgets about the negative stuff. And it remembers what it wants to.
Well, some
I want that cigarette.
Remember the negative.
Well,
stuff.
Yeah, some do. Yours and mine do. But we're probably vulnerable to this just as well, because our minds get imprinted with certain kinds of thoughts, and we think about the things we want to. Our emotions are what run us. We use our logic to justify how we feel. And so when you're buying, say, a product like a cigarette, and one group is given a warning label with it, and the other group is not given a warning label with it. And then you look at sales immediately after this whole thing happened, sales go down by about 75%. But when the smokers are told that cigarettes would arrive in 3 months, the warning backfired because the number of cigarettes they purchased actually increased over the people that didn't get the warning by almost 500%. What's going on there? So it has to be that they're remembering, I like cigarettes, I want them. You repress the side effects that you don't want.
They're conveniently forgetting the negative.
It's automatically. It's not something that you consciously do. It's like that placebo that's got placebo written on it. You know it's a placebo intellectually, but 6 weeks later, you're better. Because the unconscious mind does a lot to regulate our biochemistry and physiology. And the same thing with...
I've noticed that with friends, too. You know, like if you tell them that an artificial sweetener or something is really unhealthy and bad for them, the next time I see them, they're eating it.
Well, there's an unconscious thing there, too, where they want to be able to continue to have what they want, which is something sweet. And they'll do it because their mind believes at some level that if they use something with no calories, that it's going to be okay. And they don't recognize that if you do use that artificial sweetener, that you're actually going to gain weight most of the time.
It increases your appetite.
Well, over time, that seems to be what happens. So they did another experiment with artificial sweeteners. And what did they find? Again, those people who were tried to sell the product to immediately after they gave the warning label out, didn't buy the thing 94% of the time. So there was a big decrease right after it. But when they gave them the opportunity to order this stuff 2 weeks later, purchases increased by 265%. It was the same thing again. And what they're doing is appealing to their emotions, their unconscious emotions. They're saying, I want the artificial sweetener, but I don't want to focus so much on the side effects. But if you just told me about it, I haven't got time to forget it.
And yet there's so much talk about putting warning labels on prescription drugs and
other
things
thing
like
there too.
That. Like they're saying, oh, this really needs to have a warning label or a black box warning. So
well, that's right.
Maybe it doesn't make any difference then.
Well,
it's going to increase the sale.
Well, it does, they say in this article, because people are impressed by the integrity, the honesty, of the people that are selling the product that's not good for you.
Well, speaking of honesty, I mean, a lot of times labels are misleading. For
to
example,
begin with.
When you go to the grocery store.
Sure.
If you look at a box,
yeah.
You know, many times the label says one thing, and if you look at the ingredients, it's not accurate. Like,
right.
For example, you can look at a box of blueberry muffins,
right.
And on the front it'll have
nice
pictures of
picture. Blueberries.
Of fresh blueberries that look so juicy and
right.
Everything. And then you read the ingredients, and there's not even one blueberry in it. They're
no,
like apple bits that are artificially flavored with
yeah.
blueberry flavoring.
Isn't that weird? Yeah.
So this is so interesting. I mean, even if it's a negative thing, it makes the product more appealing.
Well, there's a certain amount of trust that comes from people who disclose things. But what you're talking about, they're not disclosing it, and people are just getting hoodwinked. But you're right. Their emotions come into play. They want the blueberries, whether they're there or not. I want to taste this because it feels good. Yeah, it's bizarre how the human mind works.
So the best thing to do, I guess, is if you're not going to buy something, you better do it not... make the decision right away. Don't say, well, I'm going to think about it and I'm going to order it later.
Yeah, right. Make the decision
right now.
Because
then you will.
Well, over time, you particularly are very observant about what's in food and in skincare products.
But sometimes I get tricked because
sure.
They are tricky.
Well, that's the art of advertising. And you've got to give the advertisers great credit. It's a science in lots of ways, and we really fall for
it. Because then you fall for it, you trust it. It's
exactly.
Like, oh, that's what it is.
Okay, it's time for a network station break. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki. And we're going to be right back with more Prescriptions for Health Radio. And when we come back, we'll be talking about, can you work out every day and still be sedentary? There's a good one, so stay tuned. We'll be right back. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Lynn Savuta here with Nurse Vicki.
So are you sitting down? Are you comfortable? Well, don't just sit there.
That's right. Get up and march or get some activity.
Get up and move around.
That's right.
So can sitting be a health hazard? Well, you bet. When our generation was young, and we're always saying about back in the olden days,
right,
we didn't have all the technology that we do today. And we were out running around and playing. And today, kids and adults alike are more prone to long periods of sitting, not just in school or at work, but at home and on the computer and the TV and the iPhones and the iPads, and the list goes on.
It does.
So what's all of this sitting and lying around doing for our health? So is it enough to exercise if we sit the rest of the day? Well, here's a study that shows that everyday movement on top of working out is important for our good health.
Yeah, you'd think that if you just did enough exercise to get your body toned up, like for 30 to 60 minutes of aerobic training or with weightlifting combined with it, is enough to do the job. But according to a Cornell University study on 93,000 postmenopausal women.
That's a lot of people.
A lot of people, published in the American Journal of Preventive Medicine in January 2014. They were followed for about 12 years, and they were between the ages of 50 and 79. They found things that kind of surprised us, that it actually turned around a lot of the benefit that you'd think from just a little bit of exercise. So it's the rest of the day matters, too. If you're sedentary, it increases your risk. And what they found was is that even regular exercisers are at risk if they have excessive idle time. So women with less than or more than 11 hours of sedentary time have a 12% increased risk in all-cause mortality when they compare them to women who have had only 4 hours or less of that.
Yeah, so I guess you want less than 4 hours of sitting a day.
Right.
And, of course, that sounds like a lot, but when you think about it,
it's easy to
I think, actually, that it's a good idea for people, now that you're listening to this, to figure out how much time during the day you really are sitting or resting or watching TV or whatever it is that you do when you are home.
Yeah.
But when you're at work, a lot of people sit for 8 hours at work, and then come home and they're tired.
Right.
And then they end up doing some more computer or lying on the couch and watching TV.
You can imagine what happened to those people that didn't exercise at all when they're like that, and we kind of know. But in this group of women, they found that the risk of cardiovascular disease increased by 13%, of coronary heart disease by 27%, and the risk of getting cancer increased by 21%, compared to those women who were inactive less than 4 hours a day.
Well, it also increases your blood pressure and your cholesterol and free radicals and too much insulin. And think about when you're on an airplane, too. It's not good for your circulation to just keep sitting like that. And you know that it can help to prevent osteoporosis. And then think about when you're sitting at a computer, when you're sitting, what are you doing? Are you craning your neck forward?
Right.
When you're at work, are you on the phone, cradling the phone between your head and your shoulder? And some of the things they found is it can squash your discs, and it can also increase the incidence of soft abdomen. So if you're sitting, at least use good posture and get up and stretch and do yoga poses, maybe the cat and the cow and things like that, and sit straight and relax your shoulders, support your low back, put your feet flat on the floor. All those things are helpful while you are sitting anyway.
Sure. And then I think that you also have to keep in mind that there are things you can do to combat this. You know, if you're working in an office, get up and move around a little while. If you're older and retired, find a way to get up between your TV programs and take breaks from being on the
computer.
Maybe
keep some weights by the couch.
Anything to change that whole thing so that we're more active. And if we don't, I mean, this is what happens.
Well, see, the other thing that happens is a lot of times when people are just sitting like that, what are they doing? They're eating.
Eating, right? Things that are sweet and salty and have a lot of fat, that's right.
But if people die earlier when they're sedentary, what happens when people are disabled and they can't be very active, you know?
Well, you can be, but you're right. It's more difficult. But even people who are actually paralyzed can do mental exercises that change the way our body responds by building muscle mass just through thought.
Oh, okay. Now we're going to have people just sitting there thinking about it.
Well, I mean, it's not so easy to sit there and think about it. You know, they did some studies on young athletes, and what they did is they had one group for a few weeks thinking about doing bicep exercises, but they didn't do them. They just laid there for 15 minutes, and they did the mental exercises. And another group just laid there and didn't do anything. They slept or did what they want. At the end of that period, the people who imaged doing the exercises had more muscle mass and strength than those people that didn't. So what we're talking about is really important. Look at the people who've had strokes. Very often, if you had a stroke on the left side, so you could use your right arm, you tie your right arm behind your back and start thinking about movement on the left side, and it changes. So there's a lot that goes with that. Your attitude is another thing that makes a big difference in how exercise works. If you're out doing, you know, the exercises that you don't enjoy but think you're supposed to, so doggone it, my New Year's resolution is I'm going to the gym every day and I'm going to exercise so I can get fit, but I hate going to the gym. It's not going to do you nearly as much good as that person that says, man, you know, I really hate going to the gym, but I like playing basketball, or I like playing tennis, or I like some other, I like running. Those people get the more out of it, because how you feel about doing whatever it is that you're going to do to exercise makes a big difference in the outcome.
Well, it'll also get you to do it more, too.
Well, you'll want to. See, for me, if you said, Len, this week you're not going to be able to play tennis at all, I go, oh, really? Over my dead body, because I want to. I like it. I love running around. That's the best thing that you can do. There you're getting interval training, right? Because I'm playing singles and running a lot. And doing what I like to do, so I'm getting those endorphins going as well, as opposed to when I had some knee surgery a few years ago, and I knew I had to go to the gym for 3 months to rehab my knee, which I did and hated.
Well, so, I bet it helped your knee.
It did help the knee. But if you've got a choice, find something you like. I mean, but also, enjoy your life.
Okay, but also what we're talking about here is keeping active throughout the day.
Yes.
Not just when you're exercising.
Exactly.
So we need to be conscious of interrupting those prolonged sedentary periods of time and to get up and to do something.
That's right.
Like, if you have a favorite TV show, mm-hmm. you don't have to sit down or lie on the couch eating your bonbons to watch it. You could do your ironing in front of the TV. You could fold the laundry in front of the TV. You could jump on your trampoline. You could do your treadmill. You could do your stationary bike.
Yeah.
I mean, there's other things that you could do in front of the TV.
Sure. Even at the gym. Say you go to the gym and you're on the treadmill there. They always have TVs there, or that you could bring your own computer and put it on the rack and watch something that you like.
You know, some people are getting desks that you stand where you stand to do the computer.
Oh, right. I've seen that.
And then there's other things where people will like sit at their desk on one of those bouncing balls, or just different things that people can do. But the first step is to be aware of how much time you spend during the day being sedentary, and you'd probably be surprised.
Yeah, well, maybe one thing to do is wear a pedometer, you know, one of those little mm-hmm. things you put on your feet, and see how much walking you actually do.
Well, I think Ashley, too, for us, for example, we have stairs in our house.
Uh-huh.
And I think, Ashley, the stairs are a good thing.
Oh, they're terrific.
Except for, you know, most people that are our age don't want to get a house that has stairs.
That's right.
We're
looking for escalators and elevators, right?
Right. But anyway, I think the stairs are good. And a lot of times I catch myself when I'm home, even when I don't have a time limit, I'm running up and down the stairs, whatever it is.
Well, you're busy doing all the things, right, to get ready for dinner and the laundry and all that stuff.
But anyway, get up and don't just sit there.
Well, it makes a big difference.
And make your bed and do your housework and get all that done.
Well, whatever it is that you do, yeah, maybe we can send it to Mr. Mom, too.
Or maybe when you go out with their friends, instead of going out to sit and eat lunch, maybe you can figure out something you can do that's an activity where you're moving. Shopping.
Oh, my God. Don't take me with you,
or
please.
Or taking a walk or a run or whatever it is. I enjoy taking walks with my friends. It's a good time to visit, and plus I get my exercise at the same time, and it's good for my mental health.
Now you're talking. All right, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki, and it's time for Nurse Vicki's final 2020 tip on more of Vicki's favorite quotes. Oh, I like those so much. I'm
These
glad
that's
coming.
These are a few of my favorites.
That's right. And when we come back, we'll be talking about how well does a treatment work if your doctor lays a guilt trip on you? And do coronary arteriograms cause strokes? We'll be right back.
A few more of my favorite quotes. sometimes people in your life will try to expose what's wrong with you because they can't handle what's right with you.
Oh, so true. Nothing like a jealous friend.
You aren't wealthy until you have something money can't buy.
That's so true.
Like love or kids or a little pet.
Right.
You're responsible for your life. You can't keep blaming somebody else for your dysfunction because life is really about moving on.
Indeed.
That's a quote from Oprah Winfrey.
Well, I love it.
Happiness does not depend on what you have or who you are. It solely relies on what you think.
Mm.
That's a Buddha quote.
Well, Buddha was pretty smart, wasn't he?
Once you've accepted your flaws, no one can use them against you.
True. It disempowers it.
I'm even going to say it again because I think this is great. Once you've accepted your flaws, no one can use them against you.
Right. You can use them against yourself if you want to try and change more. That's not a bad idea.
Morality, doing what is right regardless of what you're told.
Mm.
Obedience, doing what you're told regardless of what is right.
Exactly.
You know, think about war crimes and things like that.
Oh, there's so many things.
Some people won't notice the things you do for them until you stop doing them.
That's so true.
So you better notice before I die.
I do appreciate you. You're wonderful.
Well, no matter how busy a person is, if they really care, they'll always find time for you.
Indeed.
Never judge somebody by the opinion of others.
Mm.
You know, this isn't easy to do, even unconsciously. You know, like if somebody tells you something about somebody.
All right.
Sometimes, you know, people can be like not nice people and they can make things up about other people. But just think if somebody told you that they knew that so-and-so was a pedophile or they, you know.
Oh, that's a tough one.
They were a sex offender and it wasn't true. But you'd still always kind of wonder and you might not want to have your kids.
That's right.
Around them because you didn't trust it.
Yeah, that's vicious
stuff. Or even
something,
you know, less serious.
Absolutely.
So, like if somebody says, you can't trust so-and-so, so are you going to be able to really trust them? Well, anyway, we recently talked about a study on overweight and how guilting a person into losing weight doesn't work. So now we have a UC San Diego study showing that patient reactions to doctor-inspired guilt and shame. So have you ever left a doctor's office feeling guilty or ashamed? Did it make you feel motivated to make changes to your unhealthy behavior or to lie to your doctor next time or to want to avoid that doctor or to terminate the treatment entirely? We're going to talk about physician-inspired feeling.
Yeah, that's a big deal because, you know, a lot of the time in our training, we want to do what's right scientifically. And so we want to be perfect intellectually. And that's important. But we also get detached from our patients. And the objective is get the job done, get the blood pressure down, change the lifestyle about something, take these pills. And there's the other side that has to do with emotions and how somebody feels and understanding them and about listening and learning and caring and being compassionate.
Well, it's not about a dictatorship. It's about patient empowerment. So the doctor needs to focus on the patient's behavior, not on the patient.
That's right.
That's where the shame and the guilt comes in.
Well, it's about a partnership. It's working together for a common goal. And to do that in a constructive, supportive way. What you don't need is somebody telling you that you're a bad person, or if you can't do this, you're weak, or there's something wrong with you, and what's the matter with you? Why don't you take these 10 or 15 medications I'm telling you to take? I mean, we get trained in a certain way, and it sticks. I remember back in medical school when they told me, you're a scientist, be detached, don't get connected to your patients. And I'm going, what are you kidding me? We're playing with their life. They need to be motivated to want to do the thing that I want them to do because I think it's right. And if they don't agree, they might have a point, as so often is true. Because look at how many times treatments that we recommend are just the opposite down the road.
Well, see, I think that many times doctors or dentists can be shaming, and they use that as a tool to get the patient to comply with what they want them to do.
Yeah.
But so how is the patient going to react to that? Are they going to change their lifestyle and they're going to do what the doctor tells them? Or are they going to avoid all doctors and go the other direction?
Well, that's right. I think it depends on how the person
takes
it.
It can have an opposite effect.
Oh, for sure. In my younger training days, or in my younger days as a doctor, I was a lot more authoritative. I said, you know, this is what the literature shows. It says you need to take this pill for that problem, so let's just get on and take it. Why didn't you fill your prescription last time? And that was a really big mistake. And over time, I learned that.
When you look back over it now, do you remember how the patients responded to that?
Yeah, a lot of them didn't come back.
Yes.
Okay. Or they just said, okay, well, I understand what you mean, but they took it personally. And that was the absolute worst thing I could do.
Or they might have lied.
Or they might have lied. Yeah, sure, I'm doing it. And there are reasons why people don't do things that you want them to do
as
a doctor.
But the patient needs to realize, too, not to condemn themselves because they can't comply, like if it's to lose weight, for example, or to quit smoking, or to quit drinking.
Have eating disorders. It's a huge problem. And we need to understand why that's there and then deal with those underlying causes for why they're like they are in a compassionate, supportive, intelligent, and scientific way.
But what I'm trying to say, too, is that they need to separate themselves from the behavior.
Exactly.
It's just like, you know, we were trained a long time ago with kids. You tell them, I love you, but I don't like what you did.
Yeah, that's different.
Rather than you're rotten and so forth.
Yeah, well, that's right. Well, too many parents are into that, and that's why they're doing physical abuse and they're belittling the
person. That's why tough love and shame can be counterproductive.
Oh, well, look at the kids that turn out to be bullies in school. A lot of that is because they're bullied at home, and they learn that approach as a way of life. And so you've got to go back to why these things are like they are and pay a lot of attention and respect to it. And if you do that, things will change. It's interesting, in this study that was published in Basic and Applied Social Psychology in January of 2014, looked at the fact that 50% of patients are subjected to shame from their physician on the kinds of topics we were talking about. And I think a lot of the time it's because the doctor gets so frustrated not knowing what to do to inspire somebody to want to change and actually make changes. They need to come little by little and slowly. Behavior is something that needs a lot of time and a lot of support. It's why we do healing circles where I work at the Health Medicine Center, where we'll spend 2 hours with patients after they write an autobiography of their physical health from birth to the present time, their emotional health, and their spiritual health. And then four or five or six of us read that, and then we spend 2 hours, which we do for free, which shows that we really listen and care to what their situation is. And the most amazing things come up, because so many people are abused during childhood, physically, sexually, emotionally, and we need to understand that and help these people to understand that they today probably have the tools that they need to defend themselves, whereas when they were kids, they didn't. And so they're at the mercy of these dictating authority figures, which are often parents, but sometimes other people, that belittle them or make them feel guilty. Teachers are sometimes the worst. Yeah.
I know it used to work on, what didn't work on me was if I didn't get a good grade in something.
Right.
It would just kind of make me want to give up.
Yeah, I
hear you. Instead of making me want to do better. And when I get a good grade in something, then it would inspire me.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing with being complimented or criticized and being put down.
Yeah,
you know?
I hear you. I hear you. I react a little bit differently. When I found out how the grading systems were, I said, the heck with it. I'm going to aim for B's and that's it, because that's all I need to know. And I don't need to put up with some of the shenanigans that the professors were trying to dictate to me. So that's the whole business of what is healing involve is more about listening and caring, about supporting, about forming a partnership, about love and connection. That's what it's about. It's not so much about trying to just get the job done because it's, quotes, the right thing to do, because that's what medicine says is the right thing to do today. So we have to take that into account and stop being more dictatorial and just scientific.
Okay, well, you know, we have another topic that we're going to discuss before our show's over. Uh-huh. Most of us want to be proactive when it comes to our health.
And right.
We get lots of encouragement to get screenings to detect health problems mm-hmm. early.
Right.
But is this always such a good idea?
Right.
Now, besides the fact that sometimes it's better to leave well enough alone, yep. some screening tests can be invasive and even dangerous, causing health problems,
exactly.
which we're trying to avoid by doing the screenings in the first place.
Right. Well, that's why the United States Preventive Services Task Force has taken a position on some of the tests that we assume are routine and necessary. Things like the mammogram at age 40, or between age 40 and 50. The sigmoidoscopy or colonoscopy as a routine at age 50. And many other tests that are, even the electrocardiogram. There are lots of tests like that that need to be looked at more carefully rather than just routinely done on asymptomatic people.
Yeah, and here's a new study showing that a coronary angiogram or arteriogram can lead to small, tiny little blood clots in the brain that are associated with cognitive impairment.
Well, they might or might not. That's right. And what I like about this study is it gives us a jumping off place to talk about what happens when a coronary arteriogram is done. They're saying the complications are about in 2% of people. Well, that's true if you're looking at just effects that you can measure in terms of cognitive decline or some other horrible problem like a ruptured artery or an infection or rhythm problems or a heart attack or congestive heart failure or renal failure or infections. Yeah, 2%. But I would say in 100%, there's some kind of disability that occurs where there's no symptoms. And when clots pop off here and they go to the brain, hello, that's not a good thing. And you're going to see some loss in function that you may not be able to measure. That's why we have this thing called the wellness buffer that we talk about so much.
So it's just probably people might have teeny tiny little symptoms
exactly.
and they don't know what it's from.
You can't even hardly measure them. But they get to a certain point and you lose enough function, then it's like jumping off a cliff.
And maybe it's not even associated with the coronary arteriogram.
Well, it may not be directly, but it's adding up to that total amount that's necessary to start to cause symptoms, and that's a big deal. So I remember, you know, my first patient when I was in practice who had a heart attack. It was a woman that was 37. Her name was Ruby. She had 6 kids, okay, all under the age of 12, and a husband that I knew fairly well. And because coronary arteriograms were coming into vogue, just starting to come into vogue at that time. In fact, CCUs were just coming into vogue at that time. I was on top of my game, and I knew that at one of the local medical centers, they were doing coronary artery studies, and they were doing bypass surgery. So I got on my little phone, and I called up the university where they were doing the procedure. They transferred her immediately down there. They did the surgery, and she died on the table. That's something I'll never forget. Was that the right thing to do? I thought it was. In retrospect, it wasn't, because she's dead. The question you have to ask yourself is, would she have been dead anyway? In those days, a lot of people died from this, and yet it was the state of the art. Where do you draw the line?
Well, you know, there's other ways to screen.
Well, yes, and there are other ways to refrain from doing the new technology that's out that may not be the right thing to do because it hasn't been studied well enough and long enough. And eventually you find out, and look at the whole field of coronary artery arteriograms. It's grown immensely.
Well, until you get things that we do, we get postcards in the mail to go get it done.
Well, not coronary arteriograms, but a lot of these tests we're talking about, that's right.
The carotid
ultrasound. Yeah, that's a little different. That's an ultrasound. That's in a non-invasive, safe thing to do. But when you start poking arteries and you're injecting tubes in there and clots form on them and they come out and they start to do things to people, we've got a major problem that we have to pay more attention to. So this whole thing about how coronary arteriograms have come into vogue and were done on just about everybody, but now are done on only a select few, means a little bit of progress. Well, we're at the end of the show, and I want to remind you that we'll be back to talk about what's new in the news and health the first and third Mondays of every month on PRN.FM and drsaputo.com from 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time and 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time. Prescriptions for Health will also be available 24/7 on PRN.FM.
And if you enjoyed today's radio show and you'd like to have more information on the topics we discussed in video and free access to more than 2,500 audio and video files, click on Health Headlines on the DrSaputo.com homepage. And remember, a healthy lifestyle is the most powerful healer in the universe. So if you want to be well, pay attention to the style in which you live your life.
See you next time.